Four games, one day, no problems on this episode of Baseball Barbacast. It will be a division series recap fest. If a baseball team played on Wednesday, you'll hear us talk about it. Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world who genuinely believes that Francisco Lindor should smile a little bit more. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. Just let's see those pearly whites, buddy.
I mean, what a player, what a performer Mr. Lindor has really always been. But after that swing that you were in the building for on Wednesday evening, wow. We are going to recap all four games that happened, even more than that, right? Because we haven't spoken since those games on Tuesday. But Wednesday really delivered the goods. I am in Detroit, Michigan, where tonight I will maybe see the Tigers advance to the American League Championship Series? ? Very excited about that. I will tell you what I saw in the Tigers, a second straight shutout of the Cleveland Guardians to take the series lead here. But we are going to start in Queens, where you were, Jake, to see once again the end of a Phillies season for the third consecutive year. Where would you like to begin? I guess we can talk about Game 3 a little bit. I mean, that was really just the Sean Manaea show, but I'm excited to talk about Frankie here.
Game 3, you're right. Very straightforward. Mets send Sean Manaea out there. He carves for seven innings. Mets lock it down in the last two. Phillies bullpen kind of implodes again. Aaron Nola was fine. Not dominant, not bad, but Sean Manaea was better. And the key moment of the game was in the sixth inning. Phillies had runners on first and second. Bryce Harper was up at the plate. He's pretty good. Nobody out. And Manaea's been cruising, and it's like, oh, and he starts Harper off with a 0-0 changeup. And this is what I ended up writing about. He had not thrown, Manaea, had thrown one changeup to a left-handed hitter after the All-Star break. One. And he starts Harper off with one. He had thrown Schwarber a couple earlier in the inning. They were nowhere near the zone. And it's just such a risky maneuver, because if you miss your spot with that, I mean, it could end up in the seats. Harper swings and misses. Then he swings and misses at two sweepers outside. Thanks for coming. Manaea gets out of the frame. Mets end up winning. But let's talk about Game 4. Game 4 is pretty simple, too. Jose Quintana against Ranger Suarez. Two crafty lefties. Are crafty lefties, does that mean they're like doing crafts?
I don't know. I just always think about why can't you be a crafty righty?
Because the ball ends up in the seats.
Well, right. I feel like we hear the term kitchen sink righty, which is other words for I only throw 91, right? That's kind of what that means. But crafty lefty is applied in many cases here. But
it just means that Jose Quintana loves doing melt-a-beads.
Sure. There's listen, many a craft could be in their, list of favorite hobbies. I will say these pitchers are a little bit different, and I would say the seasons that they were having are also very different, right? Ranger, this unbelievable first half where it's like, oh, here we go. The Phillies have three, frontline guys, and then obviously Sanchez is having a good season too. He sort of, gets hurt, he tails off, whereas Quintana was something of a punchline in the beginning of the season. Remember, he's their emergency opening day starter when Senga goes down. But as you tweeted, and as obviously you watched, I mean, he has been fantastic for them recently. So, but both of these guys really showed up in this one.
Yeah, I mean, Quintana, I think he's allowed three earned runs in his last 46 innings or something. Like, that's nuts, dude. That's crazy. Wild.
And, yeah, well, and again, it's just such a big deal as I was, looking at these Mets going into the postseason and just thinking like, okay, so how are they going to get enough outs? What is the state of this rotation? But it really has been a strength. And when you combine that with the star power that we know they have had all season on offense, you can go on a nice little run here.
Ranger Suarez puts himself in and out of trouble in the early going, loading the bases in the first and the second inning. And just slithering his way out of trouble. Suarez has been a postseason performer for the Phillies the last couple of years. He pretty much delivered again in this one. The Phillies push a run across in the fourth inning. On their first hit of the game was a Nick Castellanos double in the fourth. Runners on second and third. Alec Bohm infield chopper, misplayed by Vientos. Run scores. Phillies up 1-0. And from there, you can kind of fast forward to the fifth. Okay, so in the fifth, Suarez gets into a little bit of trouble. Two guys on, strikes out Nimmo, and they bring in Jeff Hoffman, Phillies do, to face Pete, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And Hoffman gets out of it, okay? But the thing is, Hoffman had been up and down multiple times earlier on in the game because Suarez was just on the edge. And they wanted to go to Hoffman, one of their high-leverage guys, earlier on if things got hairy. And because of that, he was not exactly someone who had thrown like seven pitches in that inning, right? It was really more work than that. Comes back out for the sixth and just does not have it. Just not at all. Runners on first and second. And there's a J.D. Martinez single. He hits somebody. He walks somebody. And the bases are loaded with nobody out. Gets Francisco Alvarez to ground into like a force out at home. Bases loaded. One out. Lindor coming up. Rob Thompson goes out there and gets Hoffman. He puts to Carlos Estevez. Estevez, who's the Phillies' big deadline acquisition. Estevez, who is just truly a delightful gentleman, like a really bright light of a man, built like a refrigerator, as I wrote. And he is tasked with getting out Francisco Lindor in the biggest spot of the season. Spoilers, he doesn't do that. As I'm sure you know, the at-bat ends with Lindor putting one into the Phillies' bullpen. Grand slam, Mets take the lead, hoorah, right? Like all-time moment. But let's just quickly talk about the at-bat. So it was four heaters. Estevez throws 100. That's fine, right? On the 1-0 pitch, Estevez dots one on the black middle away, and Lindor swings through it. Then he tries to go inside, and he misses for a 2-1 count, and then he goes back away. It's basically he's trying to throw the same exact pitch he threw on the 1-0 count. And it just creeps a little bit too much over the dish. Lindor meets it. Meets the moment. Ball flies out and the place explodes. It's the type of postseason moment we'll be thinking about forever. Like, it was so cool.
Yeah. I mean, as you wrote, it's a postseason home run that will just be everywhere. Especially it being at home. In terms of just a highlight that will be ever. I mean, I think that, you know, Carpenter's swing off Clase could be similar depending on how far Detroit goes, because it was just such a singular moment in terms of who it was, and particularly who it was against. And I would also say that continues the theme of just how many closers we've already seen.
I'm going to push back against that, Jordan. I'm going to push back against that. With all due respect to Kerry Carpenter and the Detroit Tigers and the Cleveland Guardians.
Well, I'm sorry. I'm just mentioning something that I saw.
I appreciate that. I don't want to East Coast bias you. I'm not trying to duck on you.
I understand that Kerry Carpenter does not carry the same weight of Francisco Lindor. Thank you. If you want to explain that to me, you can. But I'm saying as far as a moment that will be replayed, that is a thing that we have been...
I get it. But what I'm saying is Lindor at home,
which is what I said.
I know.
All those things are true. All those things are true.
With all due respect to the American League Central.
That's fine. Again, it's not as big of a moment. I'm sorry I even mentioned it. I'm sorry. Forgive me.
That home run never happened. It downplays the success of Kerry Carpenter. It's a disservice to him to put him next to someone as cold-blooded and as stony and dynamic as Francisco Lindor. Go ahead.
The reason I brought it up is not because of where it will stand in the franchise lore. Is more because, again, Clase beat Devin Williams, beat Diaz. I know he finished this one. Beat Hader, beat Estevez. This is our guy. You know, we got to come get this closer. Beat.
Booyah.
This is just how, again, relievers are relievers, and you want to think that you go and get these guys. And sometimes they do show up, right? Like the Padres, so far for them, what we saw from them, especially in Game 3, was the four relievers that they have assembled for this moment that we've been talking about for months to dominate at the end of the game, right? That I know I'm skipping ahead here with Estrada and Adam and Scott and Suarez. Like they do. Sometimes they do, but they are not invincible. And especially for Estevez too, right? Coming in here in the biggest spot of the game, biggest spot of the series, biggest spot of the season in the sixth inning. But Lindor is just, he is having moment after moment after moment. And now as we zoom in on Lindor here in particular, I just, not that we haven't talked about him plenty over the last few months, but it's, I do want to go back to the middle of the season when we were having Francisco Lindor All-Star discourse. And I came on this show and when everyone was super angry that he was being, you know, snubbed for the All-Star game, I was like, look, I mean, at the end of June, he had like a 750 OPS. I was like, Francisco Lindor is amazing, but he is not having one of his best seasons. I genuinely believe that. And I think that was fair. I think that was fair. However, since the start of July, he has like a 950 OPS and he's delivered like four of the most memorable swings for the Mets in years, right? And so it was never a matter of doubting his overall talent, but it is a reminder that it wasn't necessarily his best season for the beginning, but it was that he deserved it. And I think that's what's so cool about that, because even though statistically, I think in the middle of the season, there was not as strong of a case, so much of what was rooted in that was Mets fans being like, this dude deserves more love and more respect for what he has always been for this team, especially as they were trying to figure it out in the middle of the year. And now him as just the leader and as like the face of this team has now matched the actual production, which is just these singular moments, clearly not singular moments because he keeps doing it over and over and over. That's what's so incredible about what we've seen from Lindor over the course of this season for me.
I don't want to say that people had turned on Lindor, but it felt as if there was at various points since they traded for him and extended him, varying levels of disappointment in what he had been and how he had performed. And I think that this moment and the second half and him rebounding from the back that he could touch his toes like 2 weeks ago, right? He is at the top of the game. Like this is a upper echelon, like, put some respect on that man's name. Like this is it, right? And I think that a year ago you would have said, what a good player, like really, like superstar. So what a superstar player. But I don't think he would have been in that in the rare air, you know? And I think he's there now. And well deserved. He doesn't react to the moment, and that was kind of what my piece was about, how these, you know, top of the charts players in these big moments don't react. Harper did the same thing in 2022. Like the place explodes around them and they're just calm. Lindor doesn't even smile until he touches home plate. Starling Marte lifts him up. And when Starling Marte lifted him up, I was like, oh my God, his back. I was like, if he had lifted him up like that 2 weeks ago, it would have been so painful.
Yeah. At this point, I'm not concerned about his back. I mean, maybe it's still hurting
him. That's wild thinking about where we were 2 weeks ago, where his back was the most important back in the sport.
Sure, sure. And it's probably good that he took those games off, right? That he did take maybe more time off than we really thought, and probably the absolute minimum of games that he, but also maximum games that he could miss, considering how badly the Mets needed him, right? So it really worked out. But as you mentioned, yes, that is absolutely part of his incredible season as well, as is just how that all kind of unraveled at the end of the season.
Phillies kind of make this a bit of a game though, in a couple ways. One, missed call in the eighth inning, runner on first with two outs. Alec Bohm laces one down the right field line over the bag, and it's called foul. That play is not reviewable. It was something of a fitting character to be on the receiving end of this bad bounce. Alec Bohm, who has been a little bit, how do I put this, moody over the last couple days. So that screws the Phillies in the eighth, right? Start of the ninth, in comes Edwin Diaz. And it's like, oh, this is so cool. Walks the first two hitters, just non-competitive, no enter the zone. And Citi Field is like, oh my God. It's like, okay, let's get the tying run to the plate ASAP. That's what Edwin's going through Edwin's head. Ryan Stanek's getting hot in the pen. Stanek told me he was hot for the next hitter that got on. So if anybody else gets on base, it's Stanek instead of Diaz. All right. But Edwin, mound visit. And then it's go time. Strikes out Cody Clemens, gets Brandon Marsh on a flyout, and it sends it back to the top of the order for Kyle Schwarber. Kyle Schwarber, whose career numbers against Edwin Diaz are horrible, despicable, deplorable, understandable. Edwin Diaz is really, really good. And Kyle Schwarber can't do anything. Swings and misses at a heater, blown by him. Game over. Mets win, Phillies lose. See ya.
Not just a heater blown by him. Heater at 101.1, the hardest pitch of the season for Edwin Diaz. Good time to break that one out. And Eddie D, God bless him, hasn't had too many 1-2-3 innings lately. He has kept things interesting. He has been asked to do a lot for this Mets bullpen. But when it mattered, when they needed to slam the door, when it was getting a little terrifying, he managed to get the job done. And the story of this series, beyond the Lindor heroics, is for the Phillies, as we say goodbye to the Phillies.
Just quickly.
Yeah.
Schwarber is now 0-10 with 8 Ks against Diaz.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what it's looked like. So but when you think about this Phillies specifically for this series, and then we can kind of say goodbye to them big picture. You know, coming into the postseason, the reason why I and so many others pick them is the three units, right? The offense, the starting pitching, and the bullpen. We have on paper seen all of them be elite at times. And I think that the mistake was, one, maybe not weighing as much to the degree to which those three units were not kind of in sync over the last few months, but the fact that two out of the three would falter so spectacularly at the same time in a short series, which is what happened, which is the offense, you know, besides Castellanos and Harper just being absolutely nothing. And the bullpen, which you had assumed you had acquired enough players and had enough pitchers in the right spots to kind of get through even a short series like this. And almost all of them had a moment of failure at some point over these few games. And for all of that to happen at once against a team like the Mets that's playing as well as they are, it's not even close to good enough. And that is why the series is already over.
Bottom of the lineup, brutal. Real Muto, Marsh, Boehm. It just wasn't good enough. And I think I'm very interested to see how this team moves forward from here. A lot of the guys are 30 or older. A lot of the core pieces. I think there's another 5 years of elite Bryce Harper. And so and another 3 years of elite Zach Wheeler. And so the Phillies certainly are going to be in the mix next year. And maybe we will review them in the offseason. The Mets. The shtick of the Mets, the grimaceness, the fall-themed gourd, the OMGs, in some ways overshadows what is just a quality ball team. Like, they are really
Bingo.
Good. They
Bingo.
Have a lot of good players. And that should not, that's, I'm not saying don't enjoy all this stuff.
No.
It's great. Like, it's awesome. No. It's, we love bits. And the Mets have more than anybody else. Okay. I'm just saying, look up and down the lineup. This is the difference between this year and last year. No one sucks. No one sucks. At times last year, like, the Mets were rolling out guys who sucked. And this year, they had a couple guys who sucked. Joey Wendell stunk. And guess what? They ate that contract. They're like, get out of here. No. Mark Fientos, I mean, come on.
Eating the Joey Wendell contract is not difficult when you're already spending tens of millions of dollars on other players and pitchers that are not on your team. So,
yes. Joey Wendell, they are good. I mean, the Mets are really good. Like, and the last thing I'll say before we take a break, if you just go back to when these two teams played in London in June, Mets were just better after. They were just a better team. They've been a better team for 4 months.
Yeah.
And the better team won this series. Well deserved. Yeah. the Lindor moment, I will remember forever. I am in awe of that man, and I am ecstatic to be lucky enough to witness more postseason baseball in Queens.
Yeah. Last thing I'll say about the Mets, we'll talk about them more as once we find out their NLCS opponent. But yeah, I mean, it's what you said. This is such they have so many good players. And yes, I understand that there is some humor in being like, oh, this is a transition year. You know, they were trying to wait. Like, okay, that's all true. But you still have, and this is what I was saying all season. This is why I was frustrated with them. Is I was like, okay, that's fine. I understand the bigger picture that David Stearns is trying to build something here. But like, you have too many good players to just pretend like this season doesn't matter. And I'm glad that they are now here because they have to. Good. A team with this many good players should be in position, you know, to have this kind of success. And so that's what's great. And, you know, when you add in everything else around it, it's just been a very fun, you know, lovable team. But that was what was frustrating in the way that I felt like people were talking about the Mets. And I'm glad that they've lived up to the talent that is now on the roster. It is very, very cool.
One quick story from the celebration. So I'm in the room, champagne sprayed everywhere. I ended up getting kind of drenched, actually. You know, my eyes are moving around the clubhouse, and I see this short guy standing there alone with goggles on, like huge ski goggles. I mean, ski goggles, they're taking up like 80% of his face. I'm like, who is that? I look a little closer. I'm like, that guy's teeth kind of look like my teeth. Oh, that's Steve Cohen. That's Mets owner Steve Cohen. So I wander over there. No one's talking to him. I say, hey, Steve, got a second? He said, yeah. I talked to Steve Cohen for a little bit, and he was nice, gave me a good quote, put it in my story. But the experience of talking to like the 93rd richest person on the planet, while they're wearing ski goggles, taking up their entire face, you don't know where to look when someone's wearing goggles that big. Like, because you don't know where the eyes are in the field of vision. And so I just ended up just staring at his mouth because you just don't know where to look. And it was just one of those moments, Jordan, that you and I talk about all the time. You Darvish in the broom closet. Where we're like, oh, okay, I guess this is the job.
We'll explain you Darvish in a closet some other time. That is very funny. Steve Cohen in the celebration. I mean, yeah, like he has, in the way that, you know, David Stearns, right? He's a Mets fan. You know, we want our owners to be baseball fans. It's really not that complicated. And it's even cooler when they are super rich and want to spend it on the baseball team. So Steve Cohen is obviously a lot of things, but at the very least in our context, he is that. All right, let us take a break. And when we return, we will turn our attention to the American League. The Tigers and Yankees are one win away from the ALCS.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Look, the presidential candidates are not the only people who care about the middle of America. All right. We have our own Midwest correspondent to explain to us the AL Central. Perhaps you, the listener, have not been locked in on the morning games between the Cleveland Guardians and the Detroit Tigers. But guess what? We have someone who is. George Schusterman, you have been at all three of these showdowns so far. Game one, the Guardians jumped on Detroit early. Game two was the Cary Carpenter home run that will be replayed for centuries to come. And game three, somewhere in between. What happened in Detroit on yesterday. Good job, Jake.
So we had Alex Cobb making his first postseason start since even longer ago than the Tigers' most recent home postseason game.
Was his last postseason start in the wild card game against Cleveland?
He had one Tampa? More after that because they won. So yes, that was one of them. But then he also pitched in the DS So it had been quite a long time since then. I think that was against Boston.
2013,
but same year. Yeah, same year. So he was asked about that, and Cobb was super interesting when he talked the other day just about his whole season. But he did not become relevant in this, so I'm not going to waste my time respectfully on Alex Cobb in this one, because basically it was Cobb against once again just a completely undetermined sequence of Tigers pitchers. And when they announced that Cater Montero is starting, someone who had actually been a regular starting pitcher for much of the season for Detroit, the thought was, okay, like, we're just going to have two starting pitchers in this game. However, that is not what actually happened, because after Cater Montero gets through the first inning with six pitches, Brant Herder, the big, big funky lefty, can you be funky righty? Funky lefty, crafty lefty? Hmm. I think Brant Herder throws a little too hard to be crafty, but you know, that maybe some Tigers fans disagree. Anyway, Brant Herder comes in, and Brant Herder coming in after just the first few batters is basically puts the wheels in motion on what is just kind of a managerial button mashing session between both of these managers, where Hinch, and with obviously the way that he's using, you know, six different pitchers, and him also using the occasional pinch hitter. But really, the really stunning thing is that we get John Kenzie Noel, the big right-handed rookie slugger for Cleveland, pinch hitting for Will Brennan before Will Brennan even bats, which is not something you ever see. You see very often that happens in the second inning. And from there, it was just like, we get Fry pinch hitting for Manzardo. And because they pinch hit so early, you had these extremely unfavorable matchups for Cleveland later in the game. Yeah. Once Detroit starts rolling out their best right-handed relievers. And for a Cleveland offense that was already struggling, it just made it even more difficult for them to do anything on offense.
We used to do this move in college where our coach would have a pitcher in our lineup as the DH in the nine hole. And depending on where the game was at, when that spot came up, he would either pinch hit like a bunt guy or like a big donkey lefty. And like, he would just use that spot and just pinch hit every time through. Yeah. Right. AJ Hinch, respectfully, I like Steven Vogt. He did an amazing job this year. AJ Hinch ate his lunch yesterday.
Yeah. And this is the thing. There many stories were written last night about just like that specifically, that just a lot of the decisions, and oh, did he bait him to start, you know, the lefties by using Montero? Maybe. Of course, Vogt defended his decisions and said, we were prepared for all of it. It didn't just work out. The truth is probably somewhere in between. The reality of this situation is that the Guardians have gone 20 innings without scoring. That's not Steven Vogt's fault, right? And so ultimately, the Tigers pitching for all the different guys that they rolled out, and I ended up writing about Brisky and Herder, who are both great, it's just been better. And it's not like the Guardians pitching has really scuffled. I mean, the Tigers only had five hits yesterday, but their hits were a lot more timely, and they did what they needed to do. You know, Green gets a hit RBI early. Torque finally gets on the board later with an RBI double. He had looked so overmatched so far in the series, and if they can get anything out of him, that would be huge. But I mean, that's the thing about this Tiger. They've proven that they can do it just with a few hits at the right time, because their pitching has been that good. Whereas Cleveland, I mean, Kwan looks awesome, and that's been really cool to see. But other than that, it's just been really rough. I mean, Ramirez has just had a lot of quick at-bats. Naylor has had some tough ones. And yeah, they've got two runs since scoring those five runs in the first inning of game one. And it's kind of that simple. And Hinch just has everything clicking. And he just seems so in command, and so much buy-in of what they're doing. All their players know exactly what they need to do. And yeah, there was some tough BABIP luck for Cleveland along the way. Vierling made an awesome play at some point to kind of thwart a rally late. But I mean, again, the Tigers pitching plus the Guardians offensive ineptitude, which unfortunately feels familiar because of the struggles they had a couple of years ago in the postseason. That's kind of the story here. And hey, listen, game four, you know, in theory, normally you look at it and be like, oh, Tanner Bibee, awesome, against who's going to pitch for Detroit. But like, that's how Detroit rolls. And it's not going to matter if Cleveland can't score. then it's just, it's not going to work. This will be the sixth time that Detroit faces Tanner Bibee this year, if you include the regular season and include Saturday. And Bibee looked really good in game one. And I know he's introduced a sinker, and I think he's a really good pitcher, and they have a good bullpen behind them. But I just think them seeing him again, plus the fact of this offense just struggling to this degree, it's not looking awesome for the Gardos. So Tigers trying to wrap things up. Obviously, the story also in this one was just, you know, first postseason game at home in a decade. And I think that is a story in and of itself that I maybe, you know, will write more about today. But it's really cool. One funny moment I'll just mention, I was sitting in the dugout before the game, and I looked down, and there's this kid, probably, you know, 8 or 9 years old, and he's holding up a sign, and the sign says, "My Tigers' first playoff game. My first Tigers playoff game." And I was like, yeah. Like,
yeah.
Same with all of the guys playing for the Tigers. Like, joined the club. Like, the novelty there was a little, I was like, that's cute. But yeah, that's, you're not alone, kid. So, you know, it was really cool. And you know, having been to Comerica a couple months ago, just stopping in as a fan, just when I was, you know, kind of on vacation, and then seeing where they're at now is really wild. Seeing it packed like that, even for a day game, for it to be that cool was awesome. So excited for Detroit. We will see if they can close it out here. But it was a pretty cool scene.
I would like to introduce a new character in the Detroit Tigers universe, if you don't mind.
Sure.
G-Mac Cash. Are you familiar with G-Mac Cash, Jordan?
Thank you for bringing this up. I wanted to introduce G-Mac Cash. That was the last thing. That was my last topic. So
okay.
But G-Mac please, Cash, please G-Mac take Cash. It away.
G-Mac Cash is a Detroit rapper who really first went mega viral when he released a song during the pandemic in 2020 about Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer, aka
Big Gretch. Because of G-Mac Cash.
The reason people call Gretchen Whitmer Big Gretch is because of this song. The whole song is basically complimenting Gretchen Whitmer's pandemic response. And the idea is that put some buffs on her face, Buffalo Cartier sunglasses, which are like a big Detroit thing. Like, this was a celebration of Gretchen Whitmer, Big Gretch. That's why they call her Big Gretch. It's so funny. Go ahead.
Which she like referenced in her DNC speech, which is like, truly amazing. Sorry, I know we're getting a little too political here. But yes, I mean, that song is so funny. And what's so great about G-Mac Cash, and I think this is like his tagline on his YouTube channel, it's like, I mean, he's a real rapper, but he's also like trying to make you laugh. And if you want, I don't know if you've seen the song, the music video for the song Coronavirus. That song is also incredibly funny and timely from the pandemic. But anyway, he loves his Detroit sports, of course. How could you not? And I believe that he had originally come out with the song. Yeah.
Sorry. Do you know about a song about the giant slide?
You mean the sign?
No, the slide. There's a big slide in Detroit, okay, that was shut down, and he had basically a diss song about the slide, and one of the lines is, "It's like jumping off a roof, man, you're gonna lose a tooth. Kids be getting on my nerves, so I sent him to the giant slide."
He has a song about this big Detroit sign that you see driving in. That one is incredible. Anyway, he had a song that was called The Lions Won Again. So my understanding of the Lions arc as a non-football fan is that they were obviously horrible forever. And then now the last few years, they have become very good. And so he put out a song that was called The Lions Won Again. And he has basically pivoted with that with almost an identical beat and brought us The Tigers Won Again. And they play it they were playing it postgame, like in the stadium. Now with the, you know, clean version.
G-Mac Cash, he threw out the first pitch like 2 weeks ago during the hot run.
I wasn't sure how recent that was, but
I need a G-Mac Cash Jason Benetti collab. Like, I need air.
I know they got a Benetti. One of Benetti's calls are in at the end of the video. But man, it's just so great. These are exactly like the baseball adjacent songs that we just eat up. So,
but the funniest part about it, first of all, Tigers Won Again is just perfect, because it is what you would say. You're like, freaking Tigers Won Again? Like, wow. And then my other favorite thing, zero names of players mentioned in the song. Absolutely none. Yeah. Right. And I think that there is a world in which you mention a player. Like if Aaron Judge was on the Tigers, he would say Aaron Judge's name. But it just lends itself to the anonymity of this particular ball club.
Totally. Totally. But it is the perfect song to play for this kind of run where that's what we've all been saying.
Tigers won again.
In different tones, you know. It's a great song to
play. Tigers won again
in the stadium after it happens. So I mean, I listened to it like 25 times on my drive to Detroit.
You know who said that sentence more than anybody else? Twins manager Rocco Baldelli. Tigers won again.
The rest of the American League postseason race. I am very curious if they win tonight, and I am there for the celebration. Will I hear it in the clubhouse?
100%.
I hope so, but we'll see.
I am literally right now. I'm sending the YouTube video to Matt Vierling and just making sure. I'm sure they already know about it, but I just
no, they definitely do. But anyway, we will see. All right, that's that. Maybe the Gardos have some life here, and they push it to Saturday. But looking pretty good for the Tigers of Detroit. Let's go to the Yankees, Jake. You were in the Bronx for the first two games. You were not in Kansas City because you cannot be in two places at once. So this was a game that we did not pay super close attention to because of the timings of our respective jobs. But this seemed like a bit of a close one. We reviewed it with producer Andrew Hartz after. And this was the Giancarlo game. It's really not that complicated, right?
The switch in outfield size from Yankee Stadium to Kauffman was so jarring, because when you see a ball leave a bat, you have an idea of what's supposed to happen to it. Yankee Stadium and Kauffman both complicate that experience on either end of the spectrum. Ball goes out like off a bat at Yankee Stadium, you're like, oh my, is that gone? And then it might be. Kauffman, you gotta get it, baby. You gotta get all of it. And there were multiple balls in this game from both teams that would have been home runs in Yankee Stadium and many other parks, because Kauffman is a place where baseballs go to die. The first one was a Yuli Gurriel wall banger that would have been gone in 22 parks. He's amazing. 40 years old, still trucking. I'm so happy he's still a character. Giancarlo RBI double in the early going, scores Soto. I don't like to complain about broadcasts, Jordan. The TBS broadcasts this year, for specifically the Yankees, not as much for your series, has been just a train wreck. Absolutely bad. Bob Costas, with all due respect, legend. You know what? Legend. George Brett's not playing anymore. And there's a reason for that.
You wouldn't know for how often they've been showing
him. That's a good point. It's just all you ask for in the postseason is energy. For the voice leading and guiding this broadcast to live up to the moment. Frankly, Bob Costas has not done that and has not remotely come close. And it is a shame that there are people who are associating him with mediocre broadcasting, considering what a legend he is. And I think that by having him on the call, it is doing the baseball world a disservice, and it is doing Bob a disservice. And it is unfortunate that this is a talking point, because it is unavoidable. It is an unavoidable part of taking in this series.
And I would say that, you know, lack of enthusiasm, lack of this, by the way, applies to some other national broadcasts that we have in the regular season sometimes. But to me and to us, like, I will always be more bothered by that than any sort of bias, because I think most of the time, although in this case, maybe there's some validity to it, anyone complaining about national broadcasts not being fair to their team, it's just, you just have the fan glasses on. And so I can't, I just don't, it just doesn't,
bias,
it doesn't
matter.
Hit for me.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't
care. I was talking to Adam Amin about this, who did the Phillies Mets series. And Adam was like, everyone thinks I'm biased to their team. He's like, I live in Chicago. I don't care. He's like, I just hope both teams have fun. Like, I really couldn't give a hoot.
Right. And you can tell Adam Amin's having a good time calling that game, as he should. Like, right?
But yes, just
I just need more juice
for Bob. And I bring this up on this play because the broadcast just misses Soto rounding third. Like, it's Stanton into the gap. Camera flashes to Stanton running in a second. And you're like, did Soto score? And then it like has him just going. It was very disjointed, very weird. Yankees tack on another later on in this game on a sac fly, bases loaded. Lugo stays, Seth Lugo, who is pretty good in this, stays in the game and gets Soto and Judge to keep the score at 2-0. Yankees, Clark Schmidt, first career playoff start. Good job, buddy. Well done. No notes. He was solid.
I mean, he was fine. He did what he needed to do. I feel like the story was more what happened after him in terms of the pitching, but he was pretty good.
Kyle Isbell scores Adam Frazier on a double down the left field line. Frazier was running from first to score that one. And then you have a Michael Massey game-tying triple, which I wish we had another word for triple. Like, calling what happened on this play a triple and calling a ball that's a triple just doesn't feel like it should be the same word. Like, Juan Soto just totally boofing this ball.
I mean, it's not an, this was not an error, to be clear.
No, however, it was a misplay.
Yeah, it was a play that there were our right fielders that would have made. That, again, not an error. I will say it is incredible how many times we have seen this exact batted ball and Juan Soto falling over and just
kryptonite.
Being like, I feel like I've watched that exact play so many times. It's very
no,
funny. Yeah. So, Juan, but no. Again, it's fine. Juan Soto, we love you. But that ties the game. And now Yankees fans is like, uh-oh, okay. But Clay Holmes, Tommy Cainley, and Luke Weaver, man, they did their jobs. They shut it down. Luke Weaver, we should have a longer conversation about at some point, especially as the Yankees advance. But the reason the Yankees win is because Giancarlo Stanton, who provided three of the Yankees' four hits in this game. Hello, Yankees offense, where are you? He delivers a massive home run off Chris Bubich in the eighth. And it was yet another reminder of, listen, Giancarlo, right, he is still a game-changing player. He is a flawed player, but boy, is he a game-changing player. And if we want to zoom out and talk about postseason performance, this dude has done it. You know, I was talking the other day about, you know, where Aaron Judge ranks for players with 200 postseason plate appearances. You know, you lower that minimum to 100 or 120. And Giancarlo, who after last night has a .633 slugging percentage in the postseason in 124 plate appearances, that's fifth highest all time if you lower that minimum, behind Babe Ruth, decent. Lou Gehrig, decent. Randy Arozarena, he had a nice little time in October. And Lenny Dykstra, don't remember that as much, but Lenny Dykstra apparently slugged .661 in October. So Giancarlo, he's giving it to him, man. And he single-handedly won this game, which now if you can win a game by yourself in October, that is a big deal. And he obviously was able to do that.
He can't run, Giancarlo.
No.
But he could swing. And yep. I think that Yankees fans have come around to that to an extent. There was a moment in game two where Giancarlo like couldn't run and was out by a mile. And you kind of felt the crowd starting to boo and then like catching itself in this very interesting way. Because he is a flawed player at this point, obviously, right? But you're right. He's a game-changing force when he's on, and he's been so good in October. He is a person for whom I want good things. And so for him to have another moment like this is really awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. I still consider him one of my favorite players of this generation just because he's so unique. And he's always handled all of it as well as he possibly could. He is someone who has not been beaten down by the expectations, the contract, the being in New York. Like he has tackled it at every turn, and there have been some low moments for sure. But he is still an incredible luxury. And that's a credit to the Yankees. And again, you can apply this to the Mets too, right? The fact that all those years ago, they were willing to trade for him and take on what was even at the time, you know, clearly a risky deal is a credit to the Yankees and a credit to a team that's willing, that has these players that are still available when so many other things are not going well on offense. This is why, you know, you have this dude around. So
yeah,
he is still a very, very, very special hitter.
So the Royals threaten in the eighth, runners on the corners with two down. And Yuli Gurriel flies out meekly to center. Luke Weaver gets the job done. Ninth inning, pretty calm, no stress. And the Yankees win game three.
Yeah. And now that sets up, I guess, a rematch of game one, where we'll have Gerrit Cole against Michael Wacha tonight. And I mean, listen, I don't know. Do I feel better about Cole, hoping that he looks, because as you mentioned, he was not especially sharp in that first game. You know, Wacha wasn't amazing either. I think the edge still has to go to the Yankees, even though, again, they Giancarlo is the only one that did anything offensively in this game. But I don't know, man. I'm not too quick to count the Royals out here. And yeah, we'll see how, if those Yankees relievers, those top three Yankees relievers who came in and had to do some heavy lifting, if they can do it on consecutive days, is going to be really interesting in a close game.
All right, let's take a break. When we get back, Padres Dodgers. And welcome back to the end of Baseball Barbecast. Jake Mintz, Jordan Schusterman, Dodgers Padres, the Spice Bowl. People are yelling at each other. Dave Roberts is saying that he's in danger. Fernando Tatis is dancing at everybody. Ken Rosenthal is pissing off the entire city of San Diego to the point that the Padres didn't talk to him, apparently, during game three. You saw that?
Yeah, I did.
Things are getting weird.
Probably warrants the discussion. We could take that off the air. But game three looked like we were heading towards, as you tweeted, to, you know, 21 win by two after a sixth spot from San Diego in the bottom of the second, and Teoscar responds with a grand slam in the top of the third, and we're like, all right, like, if Michael King and Walker Buehler don't have it, we're kind of in for a long night. But that was practically all the score. And I should mention Mookie, this is one of just the most bizarre baseball sequences of all time. The fact that he hit truly an identical home run in a different park to down the left field line that Profar gets a glove on as he robbed him earlier in the series. But ultimately, Profar cannot catch this one, and Mookie is looking a lot better, a lot faster. So credit to him for really turning that around. But he goes yard again, six from the San Diego. We got a Tatis homer off Buehler in the second, and then Teoscar responds with the grand slam off of Michael King's sweeper. Mookie's homer was also off of Michael King's sweeper. Michael King's sweeper is so aesthetically pleasing, both when it's allowing home runs and when it's striking guys out. that's what's so great about that pitch, is if you hang it, it is just as enjoyable to watch as when you have Travis d'Arnaud swinging at a pitch in the other dugout. But anyway, Michael King and Walker Buehler were okay, right? I mean, the fact that Buehler still managed to get through five innings with zero strikeouts,
very Taiwan Walker coded,
is I guess a credit to him. But
Taiwan Walker Buehler.
Yeah, but I guess, you know, you're not exactly feeling great. But I mean, the story of this game really is that after those first three chaotic innings, as I mentioned earlier, Estrada, Adams, Scott, and Suarez just shut it down. You know, they combined for six strikeouts over four innings and allowed one hit, no walks. And I mean, that was the whole point. I kind of wrote about that in our preview on Yahoo before the series. At some point, it was going to come down to a one-run game where you were going to roll out the bullpen exactly as planned, and they had to do their job, and that is what happened. They did that in game three. And so that put the Padres one win away from the NLCS going into last night's game. Do you have anything else on game three?
No, I think the next important note is just what happens in between the two games, which is the Padres opting to go with Michael King, with Dylan Cease on short rest to start game four, a decision that almost immediately backfires.
Yeah. And Cease was throwing 100 in the first inning, but it wasn't working out. But by the way, this is against the, a planned Dodgers bullpen game. But we get another Mookie home run, just in the top of the first here, and then we get an Ohtani RBI single, and that's the end of Dylan Cease's day. And then here comes Brian Hoeing again. At this point, when they're already down, the Padres aren't necessarily going to bring in their A relievers. And Brian Hoeing, who has been very, very good for them, it did not go so well here. And this is where the game kind of starts to get out of hand. Meanwhile, the Dodgers are rolling out. I think it ended up being eight pitchers. Yeah.
Brazier, Bonda, Kopech, Vesia, Phillips, Hudson, Trinan, Knack. Smells like a win to me.
I mean, there it was. The shutout via eight different pitchers is really, that's just what happened here. And this happens in the postseason. This happens in the regular season. Like these games work. It ain't pretty, but oftentimes they work. Sometimes they backfire spectacularly, right? Like it happened to Detroit in game one against the Cleveland, but oftentimes it works pretty well.
Multiple things could be true. Is this strategy optimal? Yes. Do I want to watch 15 different pitchers appear? That's what happened in this game. Both sides combined. Yeah. 15 different pitchers appear in a postseason game. No. That is not entertaining. It is not thrilling. It is hard to follow. Relievers, and I am one to my core, we are harder to care about because you see us less, right? They're less interesting characters. They simply are. There are some interesting reliever characters. Edmund Diaz is one. But as a whole, I want to see fewer pitchers. And so I don't think like baseball is broken. We're not those people. However, I think it's also important to say this is less good.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, obviously, in a game where the Dodgers score eight, how easy was it going to be for San Diego to win anyway? But yeah, we get a Lux homer off Wandy, which is probably an encouraging sign. That's definitely not something I would have expected to see at any point during this postseason. Will Smith, it's a home run too. So yeah, I mean, listen, with the Dodgers, they are flawed, and now we head to for Game Five where we don't really know who is going to start for the Dodgers. We are almost, I think it's already announced that Darvish will start for San Diego, but. And we saw him in game two, and he was obviously excellent. Yamamoto, if he starts on Friday, I believe that would be with the least amount of rest that he's had between starts. I know he didn't pitch very much in that first game, but that's definitely something to watch. Or Jack Flaherty, who was apparently warming at some point during last night's game. Again, there's a day between these two games here before we get to Friday, so maybe that factors into it. But presumably, in this elimination game, most pitchers will be available, and they will use them in some order. So Yamamoto, of course, is the most interesting one there. It would have been more interesting had he not looked as shaky as he did earlier in the series. But he is still, I think, the pitcher I'm most intrigued by going into this last game here.
Is there anything more of appropriate than rolling out of cold nitre services to turn on the Brooklyn Dodgers? Boy, oh boy, I can't wait. My ancestors would be so proud. My father from Flatbush.
What?
He remembers he was born after the Dodgers left, but he remembers.
Well, let me tell you, those are quote unquote ancestors. They would not enjoy bullpen games.
No.
I don't know what exactly the pitching sequence is going to be in this game five, but if we're going to respect the Kipper, let's get some quality starts out of both ball clubs here. I know you, Darvish, can deliver that. I feel pretty good about that. And by the way, I should also just say, like, what an opportunity and a stage for Darvish after what he had already done in this series. I mean, if he does that twice to knock out the Dodgers, I mean, you're really, really getting some street cred. Not that they don't already love him there, but that would be really something.
The Padres letting Dylan Cease face Ohtani twice and then pulling him right afterwards felt very odd in this game too. Some iffy managerial decisions from Schilt, who I generally like. I just, I thought the Padres were just going to bury him in game four. Yeah. I really did. And I'm game five is going to be a zoo. It's going to be bonkers. I am very excited to watch that one. Briefly, I mean, I actually do want to talk about the Ken Rosenthal thing very quickly. So Ken Rosenthal wrote a column at The Athletic about Manny Machado and the Padres. Obviously, we love Ken. Like, he's Ken's Ken. Did not love this column for a couple different reasons. Like, I just thought that it was unnecessary. And, like, I do think that at points in his career, Machado has been immature and shown immaturity. I think that he's grown a lot. And I just think that, like, framing him in that way was just not necessary. And, you know, I love Ken. And the team deciding to not talk to Ken, I thought was kind of juvenile as well. However, that's their right. Like, it's silly.
I was more in favor of how Tatis handled it, which was so Ken referred to him as a dancing peacock.
Yeah,
which Tatis posted on Instagram. Thanks, shouts out to Apple for the emojis of a peacock and a dancing man.
Great.
Which Tatis immediately, that's how you do it. That's how you do it. Tatis is delightful. We love him too. All right. So yeah, game five, that'll be fun. And Darvish, Yamamoto, a lot going on here. And obviously if the Dodgers lose, I mean, boy, oh boy. What an end to this ridiculous first year of Shohei Ohtani that would be. All right, Jake, two things before we get out of here. The first thing is a lot less important than the second one, but I do want to mention it. The first one, which is not that important, but I'm excited about it, is just a reminder that you can play Backyard Baseball today.
Not
if you have a PC, I should say. If you have a PC, you can play Backyard Baseball today. That is out now on Steam, Backyard Baseball 97. I'm very excited about that. So I wanted to mention that because that is happening. Much more importantly, because it is a bit of, you know, news that is expanded beyond baseball, but of course has impacted our space, at least in a little way, is, of course, what is happening in Florida with the hurricane and the, I mean, downright shocking images of last night of the roof of Tropicana Field being completely destroyed.
Just gone. Just totally gone.
And I think it's very simple. I mean, the images speak for themselves, but it's not like this is the first storm that's rolled through this area. And the trop's been there for a while. And
just quickly, this is really the first major storm of this size that's hit Tampa like this directly.
Sure. Clearly. I mean, when you see, and I guess that speaks more to my point where it's just like, that speaks to the power of this thing. And obviously, if we have any listeners down in that area that have obviously either already evacuated or have stayed, I mean, it's terrifying. I mean, and this time of year is very upsetting and concerning to watch from afar.
I've family down there, and you know, it is not exactly an easy time. And there are, you know, a lot of people around baseball who are from there or live there or have homes there, like Pete Alonso, right? Yeah. Born and raised in Tampa, he was very clearly on his mind last night, like during the celebration. So thoughts go out to anybody who's there or had to evacuate. Thank you, folks, for listening. Thank you, Andrew Hartz, for producing. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Thank you, Jordan, for being my friend.
Email us, baseballbarbcast@gmail.com, BARBcast. We will be back, I think, tomorrow to recap these game fours in the American League side. But until then, thank you all for listening.